Every year in the Ango or practice period that we are in the midst of now, there's a focus on a particular text, often a classic Zen poem or some particular fine, refined text. And so we take that or a selection from that into the morning service for that period of time. And so this month, in the morning service, incense is offered. Everyone offers bows. There's a deep respect, a kind of reverence, and we stand and we recite the triple treasure, the refuges. We take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and then we sit down and talk about lettuce. It is the most amazing thing. It really knocked my socks off. We sit down only in this wonderful, noble, foolish tradition of Soto Zen, as far as I know, and maybe only in America. They might not do lettuce in morning service in Japan. Anywhere I practice, they didn't. But we sit down, and as our sacred text, our most profound formal observance, we say together, when you prepare food, never view the ingredients from some commonly held perspective. Put your awakened mind to work, making a constant effort to serve meals full of variety. Handle even a single leaf of lettuce in such a way that it manifests the body of the Buddha. It's very cool. It's really, really good. This is the Soto Zen practice says you don't ever try to set out on a path that leaves behind the reality of lettuce. And do you have good shoes on the way? You know, with this body and mind and with none other are you going to practice. Handle a single leaf of a green in such a way that it manifests the body of the Buddha. Why? Because this in turn allows the Buddha to manifest through the leaf. This is an interactive universe. What we treat as Buddha remembers, knows that it's Buddha, and Buddha comes forth and then reminds us that Buddha is in the air. And the Buddha is in the air, here and in us and between us, and back and forth. Never happens in isolation, if there is such a thing as isolation, which is questionable. So where lettuce leaf is Buddha, you know, in math, there's an equal sign for equal, but there's a three lines together that say, this is exactly that. So we're saying where lettuce leaf and Buddha are exactly simultaneous, that's called magnanimous mind. And magnanimous mind is the aspect of this wonderful instructions for the cook that I'd like to focus on today. And that came up a couple of weeks ago when Dogen talked on what Dogen had presented as the three minds, the three attitudes of our life, our practice in the kitchen, on the cushion, wherever we find ourselves. The three minds of a joyful mind, a nurturing or parental mind, and a magnanimous mind. So today is the magnanimous mind. Now when we put the lettuce leaf as Buddha and Buddha emerging from the lettuce leaf, is where we hold that is where we can see how important our ordinary human activity is. When you see Buddha in a blade of grass or in the person you're talking to, and when you learn to treat that blade of grass or that person as Buddha, we teach ourselves our whole life what that might be to treat things as Buddha. This in turn allows the situation in which Buddha expresses through that lettuce leaf, through that person, through you. this isn't something that happens somewhere else or in some great rarefied or refined other place. This is your life and mine. And this is our life on Buddha. It's a lot better than a life on drugs. This is your life manifesting Buddha. So what kind of mind or attitude allows us to see in, and act in this way? In Dogen's instructions for the cook, he talks about the mind of equality. We've heard a lot about sand and rice, sifting the rice from the sand and the sand from the rice, and do you love one and hate the other, and do you throw one away, and which one? This is all about holding valued and disparaged or unwanted things without prejudice, without bias, in some sense equally. Not as the same. We'd really rather eat rice than sand for dinner, unless we're maybe chickens, need a little sand in their gullets. So what kind of equality are we talking about? A porcelain teacup is different from an iron pot. So to treat them equally isn't to ignore or deny the differences. It's a kind of equality that values each thing as it is in the differences. But to value each thing as it is to see the differences and to value each thing appropriately, and from that we can be reminded to understand that there is something held in common, a shared nature, a way, in fact, in which you could say they are the same. So to treat a porcelain teacup and an iron pot equally is first to see and take care of the differences between them. You have to treat the teacup as a teacup. Otherwise, it's pointless. And treat the pot as a pot. And so as Dogen says, probably going to put the teacup on a high shelf and the iron pot on a low shelf. Oh, are you going to do that with a mind that is holding up the teacup as better than the iron pot? We tend to put high above low. That's one of our typical biases of the mind. Well, the teacup is better off on a high shelf, A, because it's light and goes there easily. It's easy on the body here. And also because your elbow is less likely to knock into it. Things like that. And the iron pot fits nicely on a low shelf so that you don't hurt your back. I mean, it suits. There's an appropriateness to taking care of things in their differences with equal care. You know, when we go, when Americans go, Westerners go to Japan, one of the things that makes them see us as crude is, because cultural differences abound, is that we pick things up with one hand and put them somewhere, or receive and give them and receive them with one hand. And everything, not in traditional culture, and in the monastery, not everywhere, but in the monastery or in traditional culture, or when there's time to express respect, everything is held with two hands. So the teacup is held with two hands and the iron pot is held with two hands. And the door is opened essentially with two hands. Actually, it's sliding and that's done with two hands. Well, I tried to open one with one hand. I got a little... Two hands. A kind of appropriateness. Now, it could be just an empty gesture. It could be a mindless gesture, too. It could be one we get irritated with. We can have all kinds of responses to it. But in itself, it's showing the body how to have an appropriate and unbiased relationship to a porcelain teacup and an iron pot. We add on top of that all our biases. You're holding a teacup with one hand? That's a bias. But holding it with two hands is a nice thing to do. It's a way of taking care of relating to the teacup. Also, you can't multitask as well. It's a very good thing that way, you know. You kind of have to do just this one thing because both paws are engaged at the same time and in the same direction. So we're in the appropriateness of the response to the lettuce leaf, the teacup. There, the different things are treated as equally deserving of attention. Not as long attention. We're not here. This is not the part where we measure. There is a kind of attentiveness that belongs to each one. And the same kind of attentiveness belongs to each one, and yet it's also different. So we relate to the differences, and we relate to the kind of a shared valueness of them all, of these different things. So this mind of equality, we're usually big on the mind of difference. The mind of equality is free of bias, and so it distinguishes between things in ways that are appropriate to them, not just out of our head. And sees that the differences are a very important aspect of how we relate to things, but are not the whole story. The mind of equality is, the mind of difference says this is here and this is there, and this person, and this person is that person, and they're different, and relates in terms of difference. A little bit of sameness is buried in there. We tend to treat all people in a different way from the way we tend to treat skunks, some of us. Some of us. I like skunks. The most of the people know that. Very much. Better than some other things. At least that's the mind of difference. The mind of equality is unprejudiced and unbiased, but it has to see the differences in order to relate appropriately. So it discriminates. Zen has this long history of saying, "Oh, discrimination. That's foolish." And it's another of these blanket statements, you know, obscure more than they reveal. The mind of equality doesn't discriminate for and against. It discriminates appropriately as things are. You can't quit discriminating. You can't live appropriately. You can't live at all. You can't fulfill anything, yourself, another, love, anything, without discriminating. You cannot express being human, which is what there is, one of the important things, valuable things we can do on this planet, without taking the differences between things into account. You know, is this food or is this dirt? Is this my spouse or is this a stranger? Is this a person or a zafu? We have to tell things apart. That's discriminating. The mind of equality says, okay, but on what are you discriminating on the basis of? And what's the outcome? You know? Are you discriminating on the basis of the color of someone's skin? That might be useful in terms of sunscreen. Not so many other things. Freshness? Are you discriminating on whether this lettuce leaf is fresh or stale? Katagiri Roshi was banned from shopping for food for the Zendo or for his home by Tomoe, his wife. I think his story is also told of Suzuki Roshi. He went to Lundberg, the big supermarket, and he saw this really sad. He always bought the saddest, oldest vegetables because no one else would want them, right? And Tomoe would be, you know, wasn't pleased, and it didn't produce the healthiest meal. So he was banned from grocery shopping. Probably relieved, for all we know. But so there are different criteria for discriminating, and there are different consequences. So discrimination means to see the differences. It's not that discriminating is wrong. It's how it happens, the mind chopping reality up into bits, and it's what we do with it that becomes so problematic. It's like dynamite. Handle it carefully, or it will be very, very destructive. So when you discriminate, you set up a pair of ideas, generally speaking. We say we are little binary creatures in black and white and yes and no and left and right and man and woman, and a lot of things seem to come in pairs. And if they don't, we see in terms of space, thing and space around it, all these kinds of pairs. It's kind of a binary mind. And it's crucial to look at how the two ideas you have connect and what the basis is for making this pair. What the basis of differentiation is and how you're using it before we go and slap a consequence onto it. We do it usually so fast that we don't even notice that there are all these nuances of what goes into our discriminating mind, our differentiating. If we don't look at these underlying qualities of what's the basis for making this pair, and what are we doing with what we see? We wind up with Russian versus Ukrainian, or Sunni versus Shiite, when people are so close. Priest versus lay. The versus comes up almost immediately. As soon as we have two things, we tend to preference one over the other, and we tend to set them in opposition, this or that. That's how we tell them apart. Versus, one versus the other. So, in our differentiating, in our discriminating, how do we see the kind of difference, what we're using it for, and the shared nature of the things that we are holding up in terms of difference? To do that, the first thing we have to see is that we have a view. We have an idea about what they are, why they are, how they are that way, why this is the appropriate pair of things to put in apposition, and all of that. That's our view. We usually understand that we are bedeviled by our views in some sense, and we come to practice to get free of that. But actually what we have to do is see them more clearly. You can't just leave them behind. They will truckle along right behind you and in your clothes. You have to learn to uncomfortably see the views and the biases, so that we understand that they're not true facts. I see this and this, and what my view is a true fact about them, because that's how my mind thinks. And not only is my view true, but they are true things. We have to keep this deconstructing our fixed ideas, with which we start by differentiating and soon create fixed worlds and then go to war about them. In fact, all of our discriminations that we make are like lenses or filters. We pick up some quality about two things to set them in relation to each other. Some details get through, others are deemed irrelevant. A fishnet won't filter your coffee, and a coffee filter won't catch fish. There are filters that are relevant and others that are not, to whatever the matter is at hand. But all of our differentiations and preferences are all filters and nets or sets of this is included for this reason and this is excluded for that reason. So they're all impermanent. The mind of equality doesn't ignore discrimination. It takes all of this into account. The mind of equality is not exclusive. So it's not going to be exclusive of all our discriminations. It sets this discriminating mind on safe ground and pays attention to the way our minds work, taking into account that our views are concepts that we're imposing, and that over and over again we're turning them into facts when they aren't. The mind of equality says truth is inclusive, not exclusive. that it is only kind of a temporary expedient to say, for this particular reason, for this particular reason, I will set up this basis of telling two things apart. That's fine as a tool or device to use right now. It's not an integral fact. Truth is inclusive. Life and death are inclusive. The inflating multiverse is inclusive. So to learn to set up pairs of ideas, not as opponents, but to give light from two sides, to give a depth perspective, that's they're very, very useful. If I say, if I look at it from this side, I see this. If I look at it from this side, I see this. I get a much better depth perspective, more insight, than if I just stood in one place. So there's a great value in differentiating and having different vantage points, as long as you know their vantage points. This is what the mind of equality is. It's not a mind that is somewhere completely apart from the poor little discriminating mind that's tied up in knots. The mind of equality includes that poor little discriminating mind as a subset, kind of a subcase of a larger field in which things are differentiated and integrated. This is why the mind of equality is applicable everywhere and is called classically the mind that runs through the universe, or you might say the energy that runs through the universe, or the life that runs through the universe, because none of one of those words is actually going to fit. It's also called magnanimous mind. Magnanimous mind sometimes sounds so large or idealistic that it doesn't really relate to us except perhaps as a beacon in the distance, far from us. But actually it's your life, and it's my life. So with what eyes will you see? With what ears are you listening right now? With what heart, with what kind or aspect of heart will you live? Magnanimous mind is always available because it's always in the opportunity to find or express or know it is always available because it is always already here. It's an attitude that is always the opportunity is always there. We can't always find it, granted. See, it's your body and mind that have the capacity to see the deep value in a leaf of lettuce and the deep value in Cindy, and not confuse Cindy and the lettuce leaf. Even if you are a vegan. Not to confuse them, and yet to find a way of holding a deep value and respect appropriately for each one. So this is our life, to see the Buddha nature or quality, to relate to that, help it come forth in the other and in ourselves. Without a lettuce leaf not being a lettuce leaf. See, now when a lettuce leaf is Buddha, it's still a lettuce leaf. That's sort of part of the magic. So this magnanimous mind, indeed, is kind of overarching, sort of an overarching term, kind of word. It's inclusive and holds everything appropriate to its nature. You know, the earth doesn't exist apart from all the teeming microbes, the termites, the core magma, the Milky Way, us, ferns. None of the there is no largeness that exists apart from all the particulars that are the way it acts and dances and happens. So you say magnanimous mind happens as you and me. And as the candle on the altar. So, but magnanimous mind or oneness or suchness or Buddha nature for that matter are words for what can't fit in a word. And it's sometimes a good idea to switch around which term you might use for something like that from time to time so you don't get fixed on the idea that there is such a thing called magnanimous mind. And of course then it's different from the thing called stingy mind. That's our human thing. Somehow magnanimous mind includes stingy mind. Or it would not be an inclusive truth worth being called something inclusive. Magnanimous mind or suchness only has insides. Nothing is left out. But it doesn't have borders. It only has insides in that nothing is left out of it in the same way that the multiverse doesn't have a border, but nothing is left out of it. I'd like to ask everyone to take the best Zazen posture you can right now wherever you happen to be sitting. And we enjoy relaxing a little bit for the talk with a whether it's a chair or a cushion, so your back is upright, the belly is relaxed, and the head is well perched on top so that it's not an effort to support it. The hands are folded gently together. Eyes are gazing down. So take a deep breath and exhale long. You can fairly well feel your mind dropping into your body when you do that. And your body settling to earth. See, Zazen is one of our most direct routes to experiencing magnanimous mind. This right here is the sitting like a mountain. Like a mountain, we're settled and stable. And like a mountain, the upper reaches are full of little gray squirrels tossing acorns around. The mountain doesn't exclude the squirrels. They're a natural part of its scenery, part of the landscape. So the mountain is unperturbed. And the mountain also doesn't say, I'll be a better mountain tomorrow. It's just as it is today. Today's mountain. As stable and settled as it can be today. It is you, as you are, who take the posture and attitude of a mountain and express this life attitude, this life posture. And rather than trying to take some kind of Zazen mind with you from sitting, carry this life posture of being present as you are, settled, curious, caring, with squirrels in the upper reaches. Dogen said, magnanimous mind is like a mountain, stable and impartial. Exemplifying the ocean, it is tolerant and views everything from the broadest perspective. Having a magnanimous mind means being without prejudice and refusing to take sides. And now, not taking sides for or against Zazen posture, please relax. You see, that's what we, Zazen isn't the, of course, isn't the only way to remember magnanimous mind, but it is one of the most direct routes that I know of. And we may even drag ourselves kicking and screaming to the cushion. I don't want to sit today. Because we've forgotten what it will be like. Sitting, it turns out to be here. Sometimes there's a lot of squirrels. It's still the magnanimous mountain. This magnanimous mind or suchness is often described as one universe, one truth. And so we make pairs of ideas to try to make sense of it. And so we can say there are two aspects of this one great magnanimous mind or energy running through the universe. We can make many kinds of pairs of ideas that will give us places to stand and try to make some sense of it. Otherwise, it could seem like kind of a big mush. What's oneness? Some big mush. No. So we need to discriminate and differentiate. And one of the great classic pairs of ways to look at this magnanimous mind are called absolute and relative. Also, as I often use, say, universal and particular, or phenomenal, or ultimate and conventional. Each of those pairs will give you different kinds of related insights to whatever we think of as what is whole. So absolute reality and relative reality are two aspects of one true nature. They work together. They're never opposed. When we start to say absolute versus relative, we've gone off the track. We better set it down and pick up another pair for a while. Absolute and relative are balanced aspects of one suchness of life that includes rocks. We're not talking about life only in a limited sense that we happen to like to think of it, or something like that. We have a lot in common with rocks. When you look at life from the standpoint of absolute or ultimate reality, you see a purity of the universe. You can see how something mind running through the entire universe, because it's not caught up in all the differentiated details. It's a kind of purity. And we are already always participating in this sense of in an absolute reality. Life is always absolute. It's absolutely happening right now. Things are as they are, each of them, right now. When you look at life from the standpoint of relative reality, or perhaps of phenomena, the many different things, the whizzing and buzzing things, then you may get swamped by the differences. I do. And we get lost in the forest of conventional ideas and prejudices. We're always living in the phenomenal world. We don't always need to be living up in it in terms of convention and prejudice. That's why we need another perspective to help us see the depths of what it is to be a phenomenal being. My God, it's absolute. What is absolute? My God, it's present in phenomena. They're not opposed perspectives or viewpoints. We're always both simultaneously. Relative reality points out, reminds us that everything is relative to everything else, emerging in interdependence. And reminds us that the shadow side of understanding that we are all relative to each other is living mistakenly in terms of other people's views. Bad enough to be living in terms of your own views, worse to be living in terms of other people's views, because we're even more captured there. When we live in terms of our own views, something may wake us up to say, oh, that's a view. That's not how it is. But when we're living in terms of someone else's views, it's much harder to see that. The absolute aspect of reality is the aspect of what is always true or what is absolutely so. And it's never apart from your body, life, and mine. That's expressed as we're deluded Buddhas. That's one of the nice shorthands for that. So don't go looking for some other Buddha world somewhere else. There is nowhere else, and Buddha is here. One way to relate to, well, as soon as we, though, we have a pair of different, these are such juicy ideas, you know, absolute and relative. And they tend to get set apart. And all beings can be understood as standing at the intersection of absolute and phenomenal or relative. We are each the intersection completely. We are simultaneously, or you could just say we are simultaneously what is absolute and what is relative or phenomenal. This is why I was so knocked out when the first time I heard Tozen, my teacher after Katagiri Roshi died, my current teacher still, stashed away in Santa Rosa. When the first set of lectures I heard from him, he said, there is no absolute reality apart from each thing as it truly is in itself. That, because till then, I had heard them as two very separate things. I didn't understand it better, but I understood something about it, which was that these occur in the same place. Whatever is particular about you and is also part of what is absolutely true. And whatever is absolute doesn't exist outside of the particulars. Life doesn't exist outside of individual, many, many, many individual beings. Earth doesn't exist outside of all the different aspects of it, including all the squirrels and people and volcanoes. So then I try to figure out what this means in actual life for me and what to recommend to you. And this is the place where I find Uchiyama Roshi to be one of the best guides. Every one of the different teachers we can study has different strengths and or different gifts for us. And this is one of his. He points out that it is you living your life, being as true as you can be to yourself and your values in all circumstances, meeting all circumstances as your life, and therefore taking the best care of them as your life, is living out the Buddha Dharma, is living out this intersection or combination of what is absolute and what is relative. At any one moment, here I am, a wee sleeked beastie, and I'm only aware of some things going on, and I'm talking too much, and oh my, you know, it's all going, every life is always almost spinning out of control, right? And at this moment is when I'm here and alive and have this opportunity to meet whatever I can in front of me as fully as possible as my life. Because in fact it is. In an interactive universe, my life is not just what's happening in my skin. My life is what's happening around me, with me. And my life is the bigger and fuller and richer the more I treat what I need as real and valuable as in fact my life. Then look how much bigger my life gets. How much more my life includes when what I encounter is my life. I was talking about discriminating and how the question isn't whether we're going to do it, but how we're going to do it. And what basis for our choices are of what we see and how we see what we see and how we meet it. So the question is, what is our fundamental attitude, grounding of all this choosing and feeling and discriminating? The fundamental attitude of everything we encounter is our life. It's a fundamental attitude from which all of this can arise. This is the attitude of magnanimous mind. Oh, Michael, this is my life. You are in my life. Closer than in some time. This is my life. And this is my life over here, this little row over here. Very much my life. And this is my life. You know? Look what a life I get to have. You know, this is pretty good. So we live out the absolute reality of life in our daily life events. It's not somewhere else. So being conscientious toward our ingredients, preparing food with our whole heart and mind. If that's what we're doing, if we do it fully, we have a large life. The time when we really hate what we're doing and we do it with a kind of a scrunched up face and heart, our life is very small and narrow. That happens. It's sad. There's no really need to judge and criticize it. It's sad. We want to encourage whatever is like this to expand, including ourselves. And in the expanding, in the breathing, in the seeing the other as my life expanding out to include so much, then we have the magnanimous mind, the awareness that the whole world is your true self. And then we can try to orient by that and live by that inclusive view. And then we forget and go sit zazen. Or forget and meet a friend and be reminded. So I think Zen practice is to look at this for ourselves. So verifying for ourselves. You know, what's so famously called enlightenment really means to verify or validate, show. There are little things called kensho or whatever, but kensho means a glimpse, right? So show is to verify, to validate. This is not the easiest practice in the world, Zen. You know, it takes a certain elbow grease and certain perseverance. To look at all this for ourselves, to look at our life and our world and for ourselves, to take the ideas and philosophies of Zen, of other Dharma and other things as well, and see how we can use those aspects, perspectives, insights, putting our energy into living, treating everything as our life, everything we encounter, because it is. In this way, we verify our life and ourselves in the world and the world with ourselves. This verification, which we in a way experience in magnanimous mind. But we verify this for ourselves. You don't take it on my say-so. Wouldn't work. Couldn't. But you might say, what Jisho is saying meets something in the attitudes I've had, the ideas I've had, the way I see Zazen, the way I meet my life. Oh, I see now what Uchiyama Roshi was saying about everything I encounter is my life. And we go forward a little bit as we go in the direction together, interactively, of verifying what is true and how to live. Now I really have talked too much. Everything you encounter is your life. See, I've had this book for a long time. It's one of my favorite books. I can't even see for all the post-its in it anymore. Questions, thoughts for a few minutes?